October 17th, Lecture 7. 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 October 17th, Lecture 7.
October 17th, Lecture 7, The Theory of Gravitation. October 17th, Lecture 7, The Theory of Gravitation. October 17th, Lecture 7, The Theory of Gravitation.
Is it time already? Poor guys. Okay. No. Laura Shager. Tons. I have the privilege of calling your attention today to the what is probably one of the most far-reaching generalizations of the human mind. And while we're admiring the human mind, which is something we enjoy doing, it's always somebody else's human mind that we enjoy admiring. We should take some time off to stand in awe of nature, of a nature which can follow with such completeness and generality such an elegantly simple principle as the law of gravitation. And what is this law of gravitation? It is that every object in the universe attracts every other with a force proportional to the mass of each and varying inversely as the square of the distance between them. If you like mathematics, you can write that same thing as an equation, proportional to the mass of each and inversely as the square of the distance between them times some constant. Now, if I add to this the fact that an object responds to a force by accelerating in a direction of the force to a degree inversely proportional to the mass of the object, I will have said everything. And were you sufficiently talented in mathematicians, then you could figure out all the consequences of this. But since you're not sufficiently talented, as a matter of fact, that's the purpose of this series of lectures, is to develop your talents in this direction. I'll have to tell you about it in more detail than just to leave you with those two principles and let you calculate everything. So if you'll permit me, I'd like to tell you not only some of the consequences, but also a story, some of the story of the discovery of that law, its effect on history, the mysteries that such a law entails, refinements of the law made by Einstein, and questions of its relationships to the laws of physics, the other laws of physics. I can't do it all in this lecture, but I intend to do it ultimately by the time we're finished with our series of lectures. But we'll see how we do some of it today. First, it all began by the ancients observing the motions of the planets around the stars, mostly the planets, and finally deducing that they went around the sun, a discovery which was later made again by Copernicus. Exactly how they went around the sun and exactly what motion took a little more doing, and there were great debates as to whether they really went around the sun or not in the beginning of the 15th century. But Tycho Brahe had an idea which was different than anything that the Greeks had, and which is following, that these debates about the motions and the meaning of the motions of the planet could best be resolved if we would measure where they really were sufficiently accurately. That if we knew exactly how they move by measurement, then maybe we could decide against one or another viewpoint. This is a tremendous idea that you should do some careful experiments instead of deep philosophical arguments and find something out. So as a result of this, for many years, he studied in his observatory on an island whose name was very good, but I can't remember at the moment, the positions of the planets, and made great tables, which were then studied by the mathematician Kepler. And he discovered from the data that there were some very remarkable, beautiful, and simple laws that the planets obeyed. First of all, they went around the sun in a shape, a curve called an ellipse. Excuse me. That doesn't just mean an oval. It's a very specific and precise curve, the one you get by taking two tacks and a string, or more mathematical, the locus of all points, the sum of whose distances from two fixed points are a constant. Or, if you will, a circle foreshortened is an ellipse. That was the first observation. The second one was that the planets do not go around at a uniform speed, but when they're nearer the sun, they move faster, and when they're further from the sun, slower. In what way? In precisely this way. That if you look at the planet at two successive times, let's say a week apart, and draw the two lines from the sun that encloses a certain area, if you did it at another part of the orbit here, where it's further away, the area enclosed in the same length of time, say a week, would be the same. So we say equal areas are swept out by the radius vector in equal times, and that determines the speed around the orbit. Finally, there's a third law, which was discovered by him much later, which is of a different category than the other two, because this doesn't deal with a single planet like these, but relates one planet to another. And it says that if you compare two planets which have different orbits of different sizes, then measure the size by what is technically called the semi-major axis, which is just a half of this distance across here, that the length of time the planet takes to go around it as complete cycle varies as a 3/2 power of the semi-major axis. So to make it simpler, if the planets went in circles, and they nearly do, then the time it takes to go around would be proportional to the radius of the circle to the 3/2 power. But it's a little more complicated when it's an ellipse. Well, while Kepler was discovering these laws a little bit later, Galileo was studying the motion of matter. You see, the problem is, of course, even if you know this, what makes them go around? And in those days, one of the possible theories that were proposed was that what made the planets go around was that they were behind them here located invisible angels which are beating their wings and driving the thing forward. As you'll see that this theory is now modified. It turns out that in order to keep them going around, you need the invisible angels to be flying in this direction and to have no wings. Otherwise, it's a somewhat similar theory. Now, Galileo discovered a very remarkable fact about motion, which was essential in order to understand the reason for these laws. And that is the principle of inertia, which is this, that if you have something moving and a unit just going along and nothing touching it, just not disturbed in any way whatever, Galileo realized by some experiments and generalizations and idealizations that he proposed that it would go on forever, coasting at a uniform speed in a straight line. In other words, if nothing disturbs an object, it'll keep on coasting at a uniform velocity in a straight line. Why does it keep on coasting? Maybe it's the angels, but we don't know. But at any rate, that's the way it is, that unless this, then Newton modified this idea and said even more, that if you want to change the motion, you do it by a force. If you want to speed it up, then if it gets speeded up, when a force is applied in a direction of motion, it gets its speeds changed into a new direction if a force is applied sideways, and it's deviated sideways. So Newton added the idea that you need a force in order to accelerate, that is, to change the speed or the direction of the speed. You need either to accelerate it or to deviate it from the straight line motion. So as, for example, if you have a stone whirling around in a circle, it takes a force to keep it in the circle. Then you have to pull on the string. In fact, the law is that the force, that the acceleration produced by a force is inversely as the mass. The heavier it is, or the force is the mass times the acceleration. So the more massive a thing is, the stronger the force. You can measure the mass by putting other stones on the end of the same string and making it go around the same circle in the same speed. Then you'll find you need more or less force, and the amount of force is a measure of the mass. A more massive object takes more force. Now, the brilliant idea that is the result of all this is that the force needed to keep the planets in their orbits. Let me take a circular orbit for a moment. It's a little easier, but it's just as true. If this is the sun, we forget about the ellipsis, some kind of a circle. That the force is not needed to make it go this way, tangential. The angels don't have to fly that way, because that way it would coast anyway. But if there were nothing here at all disturbing, it would go off in a straight line. But the direction of the deviation of the actual motion from the line that it would have gone if there were no force is then, as you see, this way, at right angles to the motion, not in a direction of motion. In other words, on account of the principle of inertia, the forces needed to drive the planets around the sun, or to control them, is not a force around the sun, but a force toward the sun. Well, when there's a force toward the sun, then the sun might be the angel, of course, and they get a better chance at understanding everything. In other words, by having understood more about the theory of motion, it was appreciated that the sun could be the seat of the organization of the forces which governs the motion of the planets. This was Newton's discovery. And now Newton proved to himself, and perhaps we'll be able to prove it soon, that the very fact that equal areas are swept out in equal times is a precise signpost of the proposition that all of the deviations are precisely radial, that this is just a direct consequence of the idea that all the forces are directed exactly toward the sun. If there were any other components in the directions other than toward the sun, this wouldn't be true. So he realized, after guessing, that this proposition of Kepler's could be summarized by saying all forces are toward the sun. And next, by looking at this one, it is possible to show, by analyzing this one, that the forces are weaker the further away you are. If you compare two planets at different distances, that the one that's further out is weaker, and you can chase through from this one and discover that the force goes down inversely as the square of the distance. That means if another planet is three times as far away, the force exerted on it by the sun is 1/9 as much. So with the combination of these two, he concluded that there would be a force inversely as the square of the distance and directed in the line between the two objects. Being a man of considerable feeling for generality, he supposed, of course, that this wasn't only the sun holding the planets, but since it was already known, for instance, that the moons of Jupiter went around Jupiter, undoubtedly Jupiter is exerting a force on its moons, and the moon of the Earth goes around the Earth, so there's a force holding the moon from the Earth, and he already knew of a force holding us on the Earth, and so he proposed that this is a universal force, that everything pulls everything else. And furthermore, the next problem was whether the pull of us on the Earth is the same as the pull on the moon inversely as the square of the distance. An object on the surface of the Earth falls 16 feet in the first second. In 1 second, if you let it from rest. And the moon falls, how far? Well, since we know if the Earth is here, you say the moon doesn't fall at all. That's a very interesting point. If the moon had no force on it, it would go off in a straight line. Instead, it goes in a circle. And so it falls away from where it would have been if there weren't any forces at all. Now you can figure out from the radius of the moon's orbit, which is something like 240,000 miles, and how long it takes to go around, which is 29-something days, how far the moon moves across this way in 1 second, and then calculate how far is this fall in 1 second. So you can figure this out by knowledge of the moon's orbit and its distance. It turns out to be roughly, I haven't figured exactly, but it falls a 20th of an inch in a second. Now, you see, that fits very well with this, because the Earth's radius is 4,000 miles, and something which is 4,000 miles from the center of the Earth falls 16 feet in a second. Something which is 240,000 miles, which is 60 times as far, should fall 3,600 times less than 16 feet. And that's roughly a 20th of a second. Now, it's not a question of roughly, of course. I can't make the numbers roughly here. But Newton made them very carefully, and it didn't work. And for 5 years, he didn't publish his results until he read that the astronomers had remeasured the distance of the moon or something, and they had had an error in it, and when he put the new figures in, it worked. This is the beginning of a long history in which astronomers have produced data which have confounded the other sciences for a long time until the data changed. Now, this business about the moon falling is sufficiently interesting and rather confusing, because you say it doesn't come any closer, but it falls in the sense that it falls away from a straight line, which it would pursue if there were no forces, is interesting enough that I would like to explain it once again. This time, however, I'll use the Earth. An object on the Earth's surface will fall down 16 feet in the first second. If you shoot an object out horizontally, it will go off and will fall 16 feet also, so that even though it's moving horizontally, it still comes down and falls the same 16 feet in the same time. There's a little gadget to demonstrate this. We have here a ball which is going to be driven forwards, and a ball which is just going to fall. And there's an electrical switch, so the moment this ball leaves here, this ball is released. And so that this falls directly, and the other one falls so. And the point is that they come to the same depth at the same time, witnessed by the fact that they collide, hopefully. They collide in midair. And so, you see, they fall the same distance in spite of the horizontal motion. So granting for a moment that this is true, an object sent horizontally, like a bullet, will go off, and at 1 second it might go a long way, like 1,000 feet. But it'll still go down 16 feet if it's aimed exactly straight. Well, what happens if we shoot a bullet faster and faster? Don't forget that the Earth's surface is curved. So if you can shoot it fast enough, you get so that if you went off here one so fast that when it fell the 16, this is 1 second, y'all, that when it fell the 16 feet, well, let's get it right off the surface, huh? That when it fell the 16 feet, it's right at the same height above the ground as it was before. How can that be? It falls down, but the Earth curves away, so it falls around the curve, huh? So that the question is, how far does it have to go in 1 second so that the Earth is 16 feet below the horizon? If this is 16 feet, the problem is, and that corresponds to a 1 second flight, I have to shoot this thing off here so fast that this is 16 feet above the horizon. This is an Earth of 4,000 mile radius, and it sounds like a complicated thing, and it is fairly messed to figure out. But if you remember one of those wonderful theorems which you can never remember in geometry, the tangent to a curve is the mean proportional between the outside section and the inside. Now, this is 8,000 miles, roughly, and this is 16 feet. So the distance from here to here is the mean proportional between 16 feet and 8,000 miles, which is then taking a square root of something, comes out very close to 5 miles. So therefore, we know that the thing must move at 5 miles a second and then will continuously fall toward the Earth with the same 16 feet per second all the time, but will never get any closer because the Earth keeps falling away from it. Because when it gets here, it's in the same condition as it was over here, and it keeps on going around. And that's the way Mr. Gagarin has managed to maintain himself in the air, going around the Earth. Roughly 5 miles a second for 25,000 mile circumference is 5,000 seconds, or 83 minutes. He goes a little longer because he's a little bit higher. And if you figure it for a slightly bigger than 8,000 mile radius and correct the 16 feet by the inverse square, it gets weaker as you go out, while you get the right answer for any other height, including the moon, which came out to be a 20th of an inch fall. Well, with any great discovery of new law, it's useful only if it take more out than you put in. Newton took this out. You see, he used this to find out it was radial. So he can't say, hi, wonderful conclusion, I can prove this. He used this, essentially, or this one, to find out it was inverse square. What did he predict? First, this business with the moon was a prediction because it connected the falling on the Earth's surface to the moon being to the moon. Second, the question is it an ellipse? In order to analyze the exact curve and the balance of the forces as it moves around, coasting horizontally, this way and accelerating in, it makes some kind of a curve, and it's possible to calculate this motion exactly and prove indeed that it should be an ellipse, so that no extra fact is needed to explain the third law, which is a powerful prediction. But the predictions go on and on. This is very tremendous. This is a remarkable law, a very successful one. New things can be understood. For example, the pull of the moon on the Earth makes the tides hitherto mysterious. You see, the moon pulls the water up under it and makes the tides. People had thought of that before, but they weren't as clever as Newton. And so they thought there would be only one tide during the day. Because here's the Earth, you see, and here's the moon, and the moon will pull the water up under it, making a high tide and a low tide. And the Earth spins, of course, underneath that and makes the tides at one station go up and down in 24 hours. But actually, the tide goes up and down in 12 hours. And furthermore, there was some kind of considerable debate. There was another school of thought that claimed that the tide should be a big bump on the other side of the Earth, because they argued like this. You see, the moon pulls the Earth, does it not? So it pulls the Earth away from the water and leaves the So one of these are wrong. In fact, both are wrong. It works like this. The actual distribution of the tidal water is a bump on both sides. And the reason is this, that the pull of the moon for the Earth and for the water is balanced at the center. They're the same. But the water which is closer to the moon here is pulled more than the average, and the water on the outside is pulled less than the average. So it's a combination of these two pictures. But what do you mean balanced? What balances? The moon pulls the whole Earth. How can it then, why is it the Earth doesn't fall right up to the moon? I mean, we talked about the moon being pulled by the Earth, but now I'm talking the other way. The Earth is being pulled by the moon. So why doesn't the Earth fall into the moon? Because it does the same trick. It goes around in a circle, around a point, which actually is inside the Earth, I think, but I'll draw it out here. The Earth and the moon the moon doesn't just go around the Earth. The Earth and the moon both go around the central position, that this is really falling toward this position, and this is falling toward this position, and this motion around here is what balances the force. It's always falling also. It's going in a circle, too. It's not going in a straight line. It's falling toward the moon, but it does that by going in a circle, like so. So the water on the outside is thrown out more by the centrifugal force than the average or the center of the Earth, which is just balanced by the moon's attraction. The moon's attraction out here is weaker, and the centrifugal force is stronger. And that result is the imbalances in this direction on the water here. On the inside, the attraction from the moon is stronger, and because of the radius vector shorter, the centrifugal force is also weaker, and the imbalance is in this direction. So the net result is to bulge the tides on each side, and you get two tides. Nobody noticed that before Newton, because you had to understand inertia in order to understand that. What else can you understand when you understand gravity? Everybody knows the Earth is round. Why is the Earth round? Oh, that's easy, because of gravitation. If the Earth were cubical, the corners would be so high up that the weight of the corners would just squash it down. In fact, then the Earth can be understood as being round merely because everything attracts everything else, and so it's attracted itself down as far as it can go. You can go even further. The Earth is not exactly a sphere because, of course, it's rotating. And because of these effects that we talked about from going in a curve, there's a certain outward pull, and that the gravity is effectively weakened on account of that. And so it turns that the Earth should be elliptical, and you can get the right shape of the ellipse even. So why the sun and the moon and the Earth are spheres is now deduced from the laws of gravitation. Let us go on with the law. What else can you do? If you look at the moons of Jupiter, you can get everything right the way they move around. Incidentally, there had been a certain difficulty with the moons of Jupiter, so it's worth remarking on it. When they were studied for a while, very carefully by Roemer, It was noticed that the moons in going around Jupiter sometimes seem to get ahead of schedule and sometimes behind. You see, you can get schedule by what schedule is, by waiting a very long time and finding out how long it takes on the average for the moon to go around. It turned out they didn't go around very steadily. Sometimes you'd find that the moons were ahead of where they ought to be and other times behind on the average. They were ahead when the Earth, when Jupiter was particularly close to the Earth, and they were behind when Jupiter was further from the Earth. This would be a very difficult thing to explain according to the laws of gravitation. It would have been, in fact, the death of the theory of gravitation if there were no other explanation, because if it doesn't work in one place, it's just wrong. And the answer to this was very simple and beautiful. It takes us a little while to see the moons of Jupiter because of the time it takes light to travel from Jupiter to the Earth. And when Jupiter's closer to the Earth, that time is a little bit less than. When it's further from the Earth, it's more. And so the moons would look like they're a little bit ahead on the average and a little bit behind on the average, depending upon whether you're closer or further from the Earth. And that was the first estimate of the speed of light, or any phenomenon that determined that light did not travel instantaneously. You want to memorize something? 1656. Now you have to answer that on an examination. Next. Next. No, that's, I'm just, you know, that's a lot of... Next is this. If all the planets push and pull on each other, then the force which controls, let's say, Jupiter and going around the sun is not just the force from the sun, but there's also a pull, say, from Saturn. There's not as strong, the sun is so much more massive than Saturn, but after all, there's some pull from Saturn. So the orbit of Jupiter should not be a perfect ellipse in doing all this. And if it isn't, it isn't. It's slightly off. It wobbles around the correct orbit. Like they say in the newspapers, it gets out of orbit, whatever that means. Anyway, it moves around, but it is not the only force from the sun, so it's a little more complicated motion. And so people start to analyze this motion of Jupiter, Saturn, and the third planet, Uranus, and worked out the solution of the effects of each of these planets on each other to see whether or not the tiniest deviations and irregularities in these motions could be completely understood from this one law. Lo and behold, for Jupiter and Saturn, all is well. But Uranus is weird. It behaved in a very peculiar manner, and it did not obey the correct, it did not find, at first it was not in an ellipse, exactly. But that we understand because of the force of Jupiter and Saturn. When you took account of all the forces from Jupiter and Saturn, it still wasn't going right. And so the new law of the gravitation, new by this time a few hundred years, was in danger of being overturned, which, of course, is always possible. But two people independently, Adams and Lavoisier or somebody, Le Verrier. At any rate, these two guys independently in different places got another possible idea. Maybe there's another planet, a dark and invisible one that has not yet been seen, marked N, which could pull on the Uranus. And so they tried to figure out where such a planet would have to be in order to make the observed perturbations, and then sent messages to the respective observatories and said, gentlemen, turn your telescope in such and such a place and you shall see a new planet. Well, it depends whether who you're working with, you know, whether they pay any attention to you or not. So Le Verrier, I believe, was the one they paid attention to. Well, the other, I don't know which way it was, which was which. But anyway, one of them looked and the other one didn't. And there it was. And then, of course, the other observatory looked very quickly in the next few days. Well, that shows that the Newton's laws are absolutely right in the solar system. The question is, do they extend beyond the small distances of the nearest planet? And the first test of this is in the question of, do stars attract each other as well as the stars attract the planets? And we have definite evidence that they do in the double stars, of which we have some slides. Here's a picture of, I hope, if it's slide one, and I remember what slide one is. I can't see it. Good. Now I can't find the pointer. Okay. Turn it out again. This is a double star. See, two stars very close together. This is a third star that's put in the picture, so you know that I just didn't turn the photograph. And here's the same pair of stars at several years later. The dates aren't here. I don't know why. So many years later, You see, relative to this star, that the axis of the pair has rotated and that the two stars are going around each other. And do they go according to Newton's laws? Well, careful measurements of the position of such a pair of double stars is shown in the next slide. And there you see the gorgeous ellipse, measured starting in 1862 and going all around to 1904. The astronomer, by this time, the thing has gone around also once more, but I couldn't find a slide for the last 60 years. Anyhow, you see it's an ellipse, all right. Everything's okay according to Newton's laws, fits fine, except the other star isn't at the focus. Why isn't the other star at the focus? Because the plane of the ellipse isn't flat on. We wouldn't be that lucky that it's moving, that we're at right angles to the plane. But this ellipse is at a tilt. And it's a funny thing about an ellipse. If you take an ellipse and tilt it and look at it, it's still an ellipse. But the focus is no longer at the old focus. So it's okay. So you see, we can analyze the stars, one star moving about the other, showing that the gravitational laws extend over even among the stars on big distances. Even bigger distances is indicated in the next slide. If you can't see gravitation acting here, you have no soul. This is one of the most beautiful things in the sky, is a globular cluster. All these are stars. They look like they're packed solid there, but that's just because of our bad eyes or telescope. Actually, the distances between them are very, very great, and even in this region here, so that they're just like little molecules of a gas just running around, and they very rarely collide. But there are many more in the interior, and further out we get less and less. This star, for example, perhaps is falling in, will shoot through and be deviated and go back and forth, and it's obvious that there's an attraction among those stars. So it's clear that gravitation exists at these enormous dimensions, which is now perhaps, I don't know the dimensions exactly, but perhaps, at least 100,000 times the size of the solar system. Let's go further and look at the entire galaxy. The shape of this galaxy is obvious. There's a tendency to agglomerate. I'm not trying to prove that the law is inverse square, but only that there's still an attraction at this enormous dimension that holds this whole thing together. You say, that's very clever, but why isn't it just a ball? Because it's spinning, it has angular momentum, which it can't give up. And as it contracts, it has to contract mostly in a plane if it's turning. Incidentally, if you want a good problem, the exact details of how the arms are formed and what determines the shapes of these galaxies has still not been worked out in detail. So there's a good one that hasn't been thoroughly analyzed. Although it's clear it's due to gravitation, the complications of its analysis have not yet let it be analyzed. But that's now we have a scale in which this distance is perhaps 80,000, 50 to 100,000 light years. The Earth's distance from the sun is 8 1/3 light minutes. So you see, we've gotten gravity on even bigger dimensions. But gravity appears to exist on even bigger dimensions, as indicated by the next slide, which shows these little things. First, from a greater distance, you see here's one, here's one, here's one. This is a cluster of galaxies, just like the star cluster, in which all the stars were lumped together in that star cluster. So these galaxies attract each other from one to the next at such enormous distances that they are agglomerated into clusters too. So apparently, the gravitation exists over distances, perhaps several tens of millions of light years. As far as we know, so far, the gravity seems to go out forever, inversely, is a square of the distance, as far as we know. Not only can we understand the nebulae, but we can even get some idea from the ideas of gravitation as the origin of the stars. If you had a big cloud of dust and gas, as indicated in the next slide, the gravitational attractions of the pieces of the dust for one another might make them form little lumps. You can't, unfortunately, as they always say, unfortunately, you can't see it on the slide. But I could see it when I was looking at the slide. There are little black spots in here, which doesn't show up. Maybe if you turned out the light, not so good. There are little black blobs, which are the beginnings of accumulations of the gas due to gravitation to begin to form stars. Whether we've ever seen a star form or not is still debated. The next slide is the one piece of evidence that suggests that we have. Here's a picture taken in 1947 of a region of gas with some stars in it. And here's some, only 7 years later, two new bright spots. So the idea is that what happened is that the gas has accumulated, gravity has acted hard enough and collected into a ball big enough that the nuclear reaction starts in the interior and turns on the star as a lit thing instead of a dark thing. This is probably a fake. It's unreasonable that in only 7 years we should be so lucky as to see the star form and then change itself so much from here to here. So I believe that this is still a big mystery, and although it's usually shown as a slide representing the formation of a star, it's highly debatable. Can I have the lights and find out where I am, please? That shows us that the gravitation extends over enormous distances. But if there is a force between any pair of objects, we ought to be able to measure the force between our own objects. Instead of having to stand around and watch the stars go around each other, why can't we take a ball of lead and a marble and watch the marble go toward the ball of lead? Or watch me lean toward you. That's easy to imitate. Of course, with a Senko apparatus, we could probably do it. They apparently have an apparatus for every physical fact, which puts them in a financial position, which is very good, because there are a lot of physical facts. At any rate, the difficulty with this experiment to be done in such a simple manner is the very weakness of the force, the very great delicacy of the force. So it has to be done with extreme care and so forth, and nobody blowing on the ball and so on. And that just means covering it to keep the air out and watch out that it's not electrically charged and so on. And then it can be measured. And it was measured first by Cavendish in an apparatus which is only schematically indicated on the next slide, which demonstrated first the direct force as measured on the Earth by between a ball of lead and a smaller ball of lead. What happened is he had two big ones here, and then on the end of an arm, two little ones. And this arm was supported by a very fine fiber, what we call a torsion fiber. This point is not a pivot. It's held fixed up here, so it can't turn. And in order to turn, you have to twist the fiber. And by measuring how much the fiber gets twisted, see, the fiber resists the twist a little bit. And by measuring how much it twists the fiber, you can measure the strength of the force, verify that its inverse is the square of the distance, and determine how strong it is. That is, determine exactly what the coefficient G in this formula is. You can give me back the lights, please. Thank you. That is, in this form here, how big is the G? That determines, because we have all the masses and distances known. You say, but we knew it already for the Earth. Yes, but we didn't know the mass of the Earth, or we didn't know what to put in here. But this experiment, of course, by telling us G and knowing how strong the Earth attracts these things, will tell us how heavy the mass is indirectly of the Earth. So this experiment for Sunday supplement has been called weighing the Earth. Cavendish claimed he was weighing the Earth. What he was measuring was the coefficient of the gravity law, and because we already knew how strong the Earth attracts things, we could determine how heavy the Earth was. And that's the first time that the mass of the Earth is determined. In fact, the only way by which the mass of the Earth is determined. It's hard to emphasize or to exaggerate the importance of this great success of the theory of gravitation had on a history of science. If you try to compare the difference between the feeling of confidence and knowledge that one has in the earlier ages where there are a lot of debates and things are confused, and to the clarity and simplicity of this thing, this fact that all the planets and the stars and so on would have such a simple rule to govern them, that they were not so mysterious after all, in at least that respect, and that nature had this simplicity. Further, that man could understand it, that we could summarize this thing in our heads and thus be able to tell how the planet should move, so to speak, or how they should. Of course, they always do what they should, but we understand the motion of the planets then. That this, of course, is the real reason why the sciences in the years following was so successful, because from that lead gave hope that the other laws, the other phenomena of the world, might also have such beautifully simple laws. Well, is this such a simple law? What about the machinery of it? After all, that's all very well. The force is inverse is the square of the distance, etc., and the acceleration goes so it's nice. But it's mathematical. What I want to know is this. Suppose that that's the sun, here's the Earth. Now, what does the Earth do? It says to itself, let me see, how far am I from the sun? And then I take an inverse square of the distance, and that tells me how much to accelerate. In other words, no machinery is given here. All we're describing is how it moves, but we don't say how, what makes it go. Now, Newton himself made no hypotheses about how it went. He was satisfied to find out what it did without giving any machinery. No one has since given any machinery. It is characteristic of the physical laws that they have this abstract character. Just like the conservation of energy is a theorem about quantities which you have to add together without a machinery, so the great laws of mechanics are quantitative mathematical laws for which no machinery is available. Why can we use mathematics to describe nature without a mechanism behind it? Nobody knows. But we have to keep going. We find out more if we just keep going. So we keep going. However, it has been many machineries have been suggested. And just to entertain you, I will show you one, which you would probably a dirty trick because you probably would think of it after a while. And then you'd be so excited and happy. I did myself think of it until I found out it was no good. And it was also discovered in 1750 some odd. However, every once in a while I get a letter from some crank who has this wonderful theory, which is the following. Suppose that there were lots of particles of all that were running around in space at a very high speed and that went through matter very well but were only slightly absorbed. And they would go through everything, flying in all directions. And of course, when they're absorbed, they give an impulse to the Earth. But because there are as many going this way as that way, the impulse is all balanced. But when the sun is nearby, then what's coming from the sun side are partially absorbed. So fewer of them are coming from the sun than are coming from the other side, where they're not absorbed. Therefore, there's a net impulse toward the sun. And it doesn't take you very long to figure out that it's inversely as a square of the distance because of the apparent amount of angle that the sun subtends as you vary the distance. So it's got an inverse square law, and everything is fine. What's wrong with that machinery? Well, every one that you invent produces some new consequences which aren't true. And this particular one has the following trouble. The Earth, in moving in this direction, would impinge on more particles that are coming from this side than from the other side behind it. Because when something is moving, it impinges the things. The rain in your face is stronger than on the back of your head. So when you're running. So therefore, there would be more impulse given to the Earth in the front, the in-moving side, than the out-moving side. And so the Earth would feel a resistance to motion and would be slowing up in the orbit. And you can figure out how long it would take to stop, and it would have stopped long ago. So it doesn't work. So that machine doesn't work. And no machinery that works, that doesn't produce more complications and more phenomena which don't exist, have ever been invented. Next, we discuss the possible relation of gravitation to other forces. There is no explanation of gravitation at the present time in terms of other forces. It's not an aspect of electricity or something like that. So we have no explanation. But there is the interesting thing that other forces and gravitation are very similar. So it's interesting to note analogs. For example, the force of electricity between two charged objects varies in, looks just like that. The force of electricity is some constant times the product of the charges. Inversely is a square of the distance and a minus sign. The force is inversely is a square of the distance, the product of the charges, but is in the opposite direction. Likes repel in electricity. Well, all right, the sign is reversed. But isn't it very remarkable that the laws have the same function of the distance? It is remarkable. So maybe it is possible that gravitation and electricity are much closer related, more closely related than we think. And many attempts have been made to unify so-called gravitational electricity. The so-called unified field theory is only a very elegant attempt to put together electricity and gravitation. But the thing that's very interesting in comparing electricity and gravitation is to compare the strength of the force, because any theory which has them both in has to also deduce how strong is the gravity. If we take in some natural units, like the strength of attraction, of repulsion between two electrons due to electricity, and the attraction of the two electrons due to their masses. That's the way to compare them. So you can't say, let's compare 2 gram weights with two unit charges, because a gram weight is our own personal interest, and a unit charge is something we cooked up ourselves. But if we cook up nature's universal charge, the electron, and nature's universal mass, say, well, within a factor 2,000, you could put a proton here, but it's only factors. Then we can measure the ratio of the electrical repulsion to the gravitational attraction. This ratio is independent of the distance and is some fundamental law. The ratio is given on the next slide between gravitation and electricity. The gravitational attraction is relative to the electrical repulsion between two electrons, 1 divided by 4.17 times 10 to the 42. I've made some attempt to write that out in a more conventional notation. All, first, to give you an impression of the size or lack of size of this thing, and second, to teach you what it means, why it's useful to learn how to write 10 to the 42. Now, have the lights, please. Now, the question is, where does this large number come from? It's not an accidental large number like the large number, which is the ratio of the volume of the Earth to the volume of a flea, because I pick out the Earth and the flea. But here, it's the same object. It's an electron, and it's two aspects, two natural aspects of the same thing. This number is not something. It's just like the number of atoms in the Earth is large. That's because the Earth is big. The number of atoms in something else is small. But you can't get anything natural which has any other ratio than this fantastic number. It's a natural constant, so it's something deep in nature. Where can such a tremendous number come from? Some say that someday you'll find the universal equation, and in the equation, one of the roots will be this number. If you show that to a mathematician, he was very upset. It's very hard to find an equation for which a natural root is such a fantastically large number. So other possibilities have been thought of to explain this very large number. One of the possibilities that's interesting is to relate it to the age of the universe. You see, you have to find another large number somewhere. The age of the universe, well, in what? In years? No, because years are natural. I mean, they're not natural. They're just human. Well, I mean, they're earthy. And to get something natural, we should take, let's say, the time it takes in a light to go across a proton, which is 10 to the minus 24 seconds. Now, if you compare the time it takes light to go across a proton or an electron with the age of the universe, the answer is 10 to the 42. It has about the same number of zeros running off the end of it as that other number. And so it's been proposed that the gravitational constant is related to the age of the universe. If that were the case, then the gravitational constant that we call constant would change with time, because as the universe got older, then the ratio of the age of the universe to the time it takes light to go across the proton would be gradually rising, very slightly, but rising. And so the gravitational constant would change. Is it possible that the gravitational constant is changing with time? It's because the changes are so small, it's quite difficult to be sure. The only thing that I could think of was the following. Others have thought of it too. I shouldn't have said more. That if the age of the universe is 10 to the 10 years, and we ask what the effect would be of the change occurring during the last 10 to the 9th years, or 1 billion years, which is approximately the age from the earliest life on the Earth to now, this is one part in 10. And so the gravity constant would change by 10%. Now, it turns out if you figure out the behavior of the sun, the balance between the weight of material and the rate at which energy is generated in the sun, that you can deduce that if the gravity were 10 times weaker or, say, stronger, say, 10 times stronger in the past, or 10 times weaker in the past, let me take stronger. I should have figured it the other way, though. Then the sun would be much brighter by, I think, the sixth power of the gravity constant. And also, if you figure out what happens to the orbit of the Earth when the gravity is changing, you'd find the Earth was closer in. So altogether, you'd get more heat at the Earth by about 100 degrees centigrade, and all the water would have not been in the sea, but in the air, boiled. And so life wouldn't have started in the sea. So I guess that it can't change, but it's not a very happy argument. It's a little complicated. So far as we know, we don't think that the gravity constant is changing with the age of the universe, but the arguments are not absolutely dead, too. Now, another thing that's very interesting now that's enough of that, but I want to talk about something else, which is the fact that the force of gravitation is proportional to the mass. Now, what I meant by the mass I told you, which was how hard it is to hold something that's going around in a circle. If the force of gravity is exactly proportional to the mass, then two objects, one heavy and one light, both going in around something else in the same circle at the same speed, will stay together. Because to make something go in a circle takes a force which is stronger for a bigger mass, as we define mass that way. But the gravity is stronger for a given mass in just the right proportion, so that the two objects will go around together. If one is inside the other, for example, they'll stay inside it. It's a perfect balance. It won't come down or up. It'll just stay there. And so inside a spaceship, Gagarin or Titov would find things weightless. If they let go of a piece of chalk, it will go around the sun, the Earth. He hasn't gone around the sun yet, anyway. Go around the Earth with exactly the same way as the whole spaceship does, and so it will remain in space relative to him. So it's very interesting that this force is exactly proportional to the mass with great precision, because if it weren't exactly proportional, then there would be some weight effect here. So yeah, but so what? So maybe it's... There's also the fact that we're going around the sun. The sun is pulling the Earth, and it's pulling me. But I don't feel anything from that, because we're going around together. So relative to one another, I and the Earth, there's no net forces. The fact that the force of gravitation is exactly proportional to the mass means that the weight of an object here is proportional to the mass. If I take two objects and measure their mass by swinging them in standard circles at standard speeds, find that I need twice as much pull to hold one than the other, then I weigh them on a balance, I'll find one is twice as heavy. That's just the same statement again. But that's a property of the law of gravitation. This has been checked with enormous accuracy by an experiment first done by a man named Voss and done more recently by Dickey. And the effect is that they've checked with several substances, and the masses and weights are exactly proportional within one part in a billion or less at the present time, which is a remarkable experiment. There's other features that I haven't the time to discuss. I wanted to discuss Einstein's modifications. The law of gravity, after all this excitement, is not right. But it was modified by Einstein to take into account those. You see, there's one feature. According to this, the effect is instantaneous. That is, if I would move this mass, I would feel right away a new force here because of the new position of that mass. And so I could send signals at instantaneous speed. But he argued there are other arguments that suggest that that's wrong, and that you can't send signals faster than the speed of light. So the law must be wrong. And by correcting it to take account of delays and so on, he had a new law, which is called Einstein's law of gravitation. But I don't have the time now to describe it. One feature of it, though, that is quite easy to understand is this. In the Einstein relativity theory, anything that has energy has mass, and the mass in this sense, that it's attracted by gravitation. So even light, which has an energy, has a mass. So when a light beam, which has energy in it, comes past the sun, there's an attraction for the light beam from the sun, which means that the light doesn't go straight, but it's deflected. So that when the telescope looks at the star, it sees it in a place where it isn't. I mean, it looks like it's deflected. So during an eclipse of the sun, for example, the stars in around the sun should be deflected out from where, apparently out from where they would look if the sun weren't there. And this has been observed. But I think that I'm better off not going any further in that now. I'll try to tell you about that on some other lecture. Finally, I would like to compare gravitation to the other theories, the atomic theories. In recent years, we discovered all matter is made out of these tiny particles, and that they have all these funny interactions, and nuclear forces, and so on. None of these forces, nuclear forces or electrical forces, have yet been found to explain the gravitation. And the quantum mechanical aspects of nature, which is that on a very small scale, nature acts in a new way, has not yet been carried over to gravitation. In the first place, in practice, when the scale is so small that you need the quantum effects, the gravitational effects are so weak by that tremendous number, like inside an atom, where the electrical forces are one unit. The gravitational forces are 10 to the minus 42 units, which is so small you can't see. so that any need for a quantum theory of gravitation has yet not been developed. On the other hand, for consistency of our physical theories, it would be nice to see if the Newton's law is modified to Einstein's law, then modified once more to be consistent with the uncertainty principle. This last modification has not yet been completed. That's the way it stands today. Thank you. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
You got problems?
Huh?
Got problems? Yes, sir.
That theory of interference didn't work. If that were true,
if what didn't work?
Well, the one about the particle failure. Then
yeah.
Then the mass would not be proportional to the weights would be inversely proportional to the weights. Because the same amount of particle hitting it will send it less if it were heavier.
No.
So the attraction would be less.
No, it would make less response, but it would be the same force.
I know, but the attraction would be.
Well, you'll have to make an assumption then that the absorption of this stuff is exactly proportional to the mass. Otherwise, you won't understand it. That's right. You'd have to assume that the more massive, the more stuff is absorbed in the same proportion. Not very happy, because it's not natural. But there are these other arguments against it, too.
You said that this wouldn't work because the impulses would be greater as the Earth is moving towards these things.
That's right.
But actually,
yes. Yes.
There's actually no difference in the speed.
But there is a little difference, yes. It turns out.
Didn't Einstein say that?
Yes, there's no difference in speed. But it turns out the following. You know, if you had, let's say it was light that were coming, just for make it clear to you. You know, when you're moving toward a light source, it looks bluer.
That would just change.
The speed is, that's right, just the wavelength. Speed is bluer, but it has more energy in each quantum. The energy in each quantum is Planck's constant times the frequency. And so it's bluer and has more momentum. It turns out that it's not, I made it an argument on velocity, which is okay as long as it's not too high. You're quite right. When it's at the speed of light, the velocity isn't changed, but the argument was still right. The momentum which is delivered is increased when you're going toward them.
Has there been any attempts to measure the speed of gravity?
No. No, there's not the speed, no, they haven't. The effect is so weak, the gravitation, it's very difficult to do experiments. And nobody is ingenious enough to figure out how to do just such experiments. So gravitational waves, which would be the analog of electromagnetic waves, have been predicted, in fact, from Einstein's theory, which involves the delay, but have never been observed because of the technical difficulties. It doesn't mean it's impossible. It's a good problem, but no one has been able to figure out how to do it.
So for all the evidence indicates that gravity is instantaneous.
Yes, but the evidence is negative in the sense that no one has made a decisive test in a condition in which we would have expected to see a delay, where the detection is sensitive enough to see. Yes, that's right. So far as we know, it's instantaneous, but it's better to say so far as we know, it goes at the speed of light, because that's consonant with the other theories and with other details.
You mean this?
There are other modifications. You see, not when he tried to modify this, Einstein tried to modify this in order to account for the delays and all this other stuff. He had a slightly different law. And then one of the there were several other consequences. One is the deflection of light. That worked. Another was, there were a few other consequences, but one of the more interesting ones is that the orbit is not a perfect ellipse anymore. But that instead of being an ellipse, it's nearly an ellipse, but when it comes back, it isn't quite at the same point, see, so like this. So the next time around, it's a little cockeyed, and it comes like this. So it kind of, what we call precesses, that is the position of the ellipse, if you will, slowly rotates. And in the case of Mercury, it rotates experimentally 41 and a half, plus or minus 2 or 3, seconds of arc. You know what that means? In 100 years. That's a hell of a thing to measure. And theoretically, according to Einstein's theory, it should have been 43 seconds of arc when he worked out this new theory. So we believe, therefore, there's several experimental checks on the new theory. And since another consequence of the new theory is that the signals should go at the speed of light, I would prefer to say that we have belief that it goes at the speed of light and some good argument to support it, but no direct experimental test.
I see. But a according to Einstein's theory, this is because gravity is not instantaneous and not because the masses increase.
It's a combination of things, you see. It's a mixture. It's the trouble with it. It has to be all made consistent. It's a very delicate problem. A lot of things happen. I explained to you that this must fail for one reason, because of the instantaneous character. But there are a lot of other things that have to change at the same time. For instance, the question about the mass. The mass in here increases, as you know, when things move. Should you put the increased mass in here or not? And it turns out rather strange that you should put 3/2 as times as much increase in there. It's complicated. You'll find out when you learn about electricity, for example, that beside the force of electricity that occurs when things are standing still, when things are moving, there's additional forces called magnetic. There's the analog of all of that. This is the old analog of electricity, but when these things move, there's no name for it, what I could call gravito-magnetic-like thing. That is, forces that depend upon the velocities. And all those things have to be corrected for, so it isn't so easy to understand just where this 43 comes from, because it's a combination of several effects. I'm sorry it's not simple, but it isn't. It isn't just the mass increasing, it's too easy. See, if it were just the mass increasing, it would cancel out again, because the mass is increased because of the motion, so the force is stronger, but also the reaction to a force is weaker. You see, because the force is the mass times acceleration, so it doesn't respond. You know, that can cancel out by itself, but it doesn't. It's a little more complicated. Yes?
You mentioned back there about the relation of the age of the universe and heat, M, and all that.
Yeah.
How about, I suppose it's been ruled out, the electrical constant there can change rather than the
other. It's very amusing. If you try to ask yourself what would happen, let's say, if the electrical constant changed or anything else changes, you find very peculiar things. For instance, let's suppose that all lengths were to change with time. The dimensions of all the atoms were to shrink, everything were to go together. Well, then there's nothing to see, because if we're all shrinking together, we don't see any effect, you see. So it's very difficult sometimes to say which one you were talking about, and it doesn't really make any difference. In this case, I'd have to think a long time before we give a specific answer. You see, you have to say what doesn't change and what does change, and precisely what you're going to assume. If I assume nothing else changes at all but gravity, then I got that one argument. If I suppose that gravity stays the same, the masses stay the same, but the charges change, then it's a little more long-winded, because then the dimensions of atoms change, and I have to think around, and very often it comes out it's exactly the same as if the other one changed, because it often depends only on ratio. So I think it'll turn out, if you do it well, that it wouldn't make any difference. But I don't know. There's been a direct check on a particular combination of constants, Planck's constant times the speed of light into the charge of the electron squared. And that shows that it hasn't changed, I can't remember the percentage now, in a very long time.
This fellow Kapp that I was reading produced an analogy between gravitation and the creation of matter. Said that the creation of matter, which is predicted by Hoyle, is the difference between creation and destruction. And the creation produces space, which causes the expansion, but the concentrated matter increases the proportion of destruction in the matter, which produces the gravity.
I think that fellow's name should have been Crap rather than whatever it was. It sounds vague. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't sound like he knows what he's talking about. You see, it's easy enough to make up a theory by talking, just like it sounds good about the bombarding particles or something. Even there, the guy is at least rational in talking about how much momentum is given. But you don't know when you create something, whether you create space along with it. That's an idea that's just hope. You see, that's not a good theory. That's not a specific, definite, precise. And you don't understand why, when the matter is destroyed, the space isn't destroyed along with it. He just says so. And that's wrong with it, you see. It's just making up suppositions. And when they're all finished, they'll explain only one thing, just the thing he built them to explain. They won't explain anything else. You see, the Newtonian law was built to explain the stuff here, but this one and this one and so on. And the moment it did that, it suddenly was obviously true because it explained other things that you didn't expect to explain, like why the Earth is round and so on. So you can always tell a good theory from a bad theory this way, that a theory that probably isn't right is one in which is rather elaborate and has been designed to explain certain facts. But then it is not turned on any other fact. It doesn't help on anything else. So it's just a concoction for that one thing and probably wrong. The truth always is funny in the sense that it explains a lot more than you expected when you started to figure it out. So unless his theory explains a lot of other things automatically, I mean to you, to the other reader, not to him, because he can always add another vague, I think. He says, oh yes, and this also explains the redshift because when space is created, I suppose that the light is going to change color. But it's not self-evident that light changes color to the red when space, you know. He adds another vague thing and another vague thing and another vague thing. You better watch out for such nonsense writers.
Isn't it thought that the universe is expanding? Couldn't that be explained by the change in the gravitational?
Yes, not by the change in the gravitational constant, but it could be by the change of one of these other things, perhaps like he wanted us to have. For instance, suppose that the dimensions of all the atoms are changing because of the various natural constants which determines the orbits of the electrons. Suppose that all the matter, say, is, I better get this right, shrinking all the time. You say, it didn't make no effect. I just said it made no effect. But if we look at something that's very old, all its scale is larger than our scale. So if we can see something that's very old, that thing that was very old is on a bigger scale than us. So if it emits light, the characteristic wavelengths that it emit would be larger than the characteristic wavelengths that the atoms that we have of the same nature, let's say hydrogen or other atoms, would emit. And therefore, if we compare them in a spectroscope, we would find their light shifted to the red. And furthermore, those things which are twice as far away would be shifted to the red twice as much, because they're twice as much older and the constants have changed twice as much in that time. So you see, that's a perfectly legitimate possible point of view. So there are a lot of other possible explanations of the redshift. But then you come back to inner circle. Because it sounds so good, but you analyze it very carefully, you're in a circle. What did you mean expanding? You mean that the distance between the nebulae is increasing relative to what? Well, relative to our meter sticks on the ground. Your theory was that the distance was staying fixed, but the meter sticks were shrinking. The other theory is that that the meter sticks are staying fixed and the distance is expanding. But you see, those are exactly the same in the end. So after this long discussion, we come back that those two theories are really the same, offhand. If, in careful thought, you can see one difference between the two, one consequence which is different, then that we must test and find out which it is.
The bending of light around passing the star.
Yes.
Could this be because of refraction in gases?
No, because it doesn't require any gases. I mean, the amount of deflection is a definite amount that's independent of the amount of gas. There is a little bit of refraction, but you can figure out how much it is. After all, we know how much gas is there from the light it emits, and we can figure out the deflection from the diffraction, refraction, but it's very small. Yes, 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 of course. The moon is only to get rid of the sun. I mean, to get rid of the light of the sun. You see, it's very hard to see the stars behind the sun because the sun makes the sky so bright blue that you can't see the stars. And so you wait for an eclipse. I should have explained it. It has nothing to do with the moon at all. It's just it's a technical thing. When the moon's in the way of the sun, then you can see the stars near the sun. More recently, they have made instruments which are delicate enough that they can make an image so with a telescope good enough that you can still see the stars. No, I don't know whether you can see. Can you see the stars with those chronographs or something? No, not good enough. No, you have to wait for an eclipse. Yeah, it's only because of the air of the Earth. For instance, if we were to go to the moon and look at the sun, then we would be able to see the stars right behind the sun, right next to it, because there's no scattered, or very little, relatively scattered. Yeah, but it's no better than an eclipse. It's just as good to be on the moon as to wait for an eclipse. Yeah. So that your film doesn't get burned over, that's all. So we should do this on the moon, and we can do it every day and measure it very carefully instead of having to wait on some Russian tundra somewhere. You know, the first time they went to do this experiment, they went to in Russia somewhere, and they got the telescopes all set up, and there was war declared, and the Russian Russian cavalry officers came and told them to, no, they can't take these pictures, they're spies. War had just been declared. War had just been declared. So these guys begged them, please let us take the pictures. The eclipse will be over in, you know, 2 hours, you know, and we'll get the pictures. They will discuss it with you. No, no, come on, come on. So they didn't get the pictures the first time, 1914. It was 1919 when they first measured it. I don't know about that, no. About this deflection?
Yeah,
it always has been disagreement. Yeah, it's hard to measure. Yeah, it's hard to measure, and they argue whether it's exactly right. Yeah, but it's about right, isn't it? I mean, there is an effect. Yeah, but the question is whether it's exactly right or not. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, you made those.
That's yours.
Yeah, you can have that. I don't need
that
it.
One.
Yeah, that's right.
There you are, this one.
No, that's not my phone. ST-15.